Well, a lot of y'all have asked for it, and here we are today with the well-known Michael Matt, who is the editor of The Remnant, and also known for his newer stuff on The Remnant TV. How are you, Michael?
Just fine. Are we Dr. Marshall or are we Taylor?
I'm you can sure. call me Taylor. Taylor's great.
Yep. Sounds good.
So for all those right. of you who don't know Michael Matt, he's the editor of The Remnant. He's the grandson of the founder of The Wanderer and the son of the founder of The Remnant, which was started in the late 60s, right? After Vatican II.
That's correct.
He's the host of The Remnant Underground and The Remnant Forum, a faculty member of the Roman Forum Summer Symposium, and the moderator and debater of the Argument of the Month Club in St. Paul, Minnesota. He's the author of God's Wasteland, 50 Years of Rock and Roll, Christian Fables, and contributed most recently to Love in the Ruins, Modern Catholics in Search of the Ancient Faith. And did I miss anything?
Other than I got a whale of a cold. No, you sound like you're
okay. All right, great. Well, you know, I've especially in the last few years, we were talking before we rolled tape this morning, I've really come to appreciate what The Remnant has been standing for all these years, which is summarizes like the recognize and resist position, which is not sede vacantis, but recognizing the Pope, the hierarchy, the visible church, but also realizing that we have a major liturgical, theological, philosophical revolution in the church, and that we have to resist it reverently, humbly, but resist it. So can you explain, I mean, you come from a long Catholic family with a tradition that's going back to your father. How did The Remnant get started, and where do you fit into this R&R idea?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, I'm glad you're presenting R&R as a positive. We that's used a lot as a pejorative. It always kind of makes me laugh because that's exactly what we do. We recognize this is the church. The church is the sole means of salvation. So it makes perfect sense that the powers of hell would be doing everything they possibly can to take the church down. And if you think about what they're doing right now, you would think they'd be satisfied that the Catholic Church is in the hands of the baddies right now.
Yeah.
But they're not. And why are they not? Because the Catholic Church is a divine institution, and they know. They have a long memory, these revolutionaries. They know the Catholic Church has been down and out time and time again down through history. But because she's divine, she always, always comes back and always will. So recognize and resist, precisely. That's what the great saints did, too, in times similar to ours, although I happen to think our times are the worst. They recognized that the Pope was the Pope. They recognized that the powers of hell were having some success with the hierarchy of the church. They resisted them, but they were the loyal opposition. We stay in the church and we fight. And I don't know how much you want to get into the history of the Wanderer and the Remnant, but that's essentially, that's what happened with the Wanderer newspaper, which, is the oldest weekly Catholic newspaper in the country. And my father, grandfather, my great-grandfather founded that. And what they were doing, they were given a commission by Pope Leo XIII, essentially, to use Catholic journalism to fight against the – everybody likes to make fun of the Freemasons. Like, it's Alex Jones, black helicopter stuff. But the reality is that the popes were very, very concerned about Freemasonry. To the point where they addressed it more often than any other organization, any other sort of separate entity organization in the world. They addressed it often. They condemned it. Many popes, successive popes condemned it.
Yeah, I think Leo XIII wrote, 4 encyclicals against Freemasonry.
Absolutely. And it's so funny now. We think, well, we're so sophisticated. We don't mess around with secret handshakes and all that stuff. But there was a war to destroy the Catholic Church, and the secret societies led it. So at one point, you know, Pope Leo XIII looks at the German immigrants, for example, in the United States, and he says, use your journalism. He's talking to German journalists, newspaper guys. Use your journalism to try to protect the German immigrants against the forces of German Enlightenment, against the forces of Freemasonry and so forth. And so that's how the Wanderer came into being. First and foremost, it was a German. It's called Der Wanderer. It was a German newspaper, you know, which was catering to the German Catholics, especially in this country. Great, great stuff to brag about. I mean, it was condemned by Pravda by name by the Soviet Union. It was outlawed and banned by Adolf Hitler's regime in Germany. So it's kind of got a great history. But the sad part is the men, my grandfather's father's were always standing against the world and doing whatever they could as Catholic journalists to defend the throne of Peter, to defend the church against these powers of evil. And somewhere after the second, very soon after the Second Vatican Council, they began to hear coming from behind them what they used to be defending, the church, Mother Church. They began to hear the same sort of message, Masonic Enlightenment and message coming from within the church. And that's the thing that's often misunderstood about quote-unquote traditionalists. Well, they're so arrogant. They think they're more Catholic than the Pope. Anybody who lived through that period, no, I was just a child when it happened. You've never seen men with more broken hearts than these guys who for generations, literally, had given their lives to the defense of the church to the best of their abilities. And to see the church go through what she went through, where she really sort of began to throw in a human element, of course, began to throw in with the other side, was devastating to these men. And so the Wander, very quickly, I'll get to, I don't want to take up too much of your time on that question, but very quickly, the Wander became like this sort of an emblem or whatever of what happened during that revolution, where you had this really tight family that for 100 years had been defending the Catholic Church, the doctrines, liturgy of the church. All of a sudden, it's just divided right in half. And so my uncle goes along and says, which is a good thing. This is, maybe we can talk about this a little bit. He says, no, it's the church. And this gives you an idea of how confusing the times were. He said, it's the church. These are the popes. This is the Pope. We must obey the Pope. And that's actually a very Catholic position. We have to obey the church. And so this divided the brothers, while then my father said, no, this is exactly what St. Pius X was talking about. This is the modernism's, move into the church. And so he founded the Remnant. He gave up everything. He was the main editor of the Wander. He said, I'm sorry, they had an amicable parting of the ways. He said, I cannot go along with what's happening in the Vatican. And so in 1969 is when the new mass came out. 1967 is when he started the Remnant, based on this 100-year history of understanding Freemasonry, understanding modernism, understanding what Pope Pius X was talking about. He started the Remnant in order to sort of anticipate that and to fight against it. And here we are today.
Yeah. And I mean, we know that forces men at the Second Vatican Council, chiefly Annibal Bugnini, who designed the Novus Ordo Missae. I mean, there's the story of the briefcase left behind in the early 70s with the Freemasonic documents in it. And if you just look at the architecture and the rites and the changes that were made and the emphasis on the Freemasonic principles of the universal brotherhood of man, universalism, pantheism, and an extended emphasis on the dignity of man, you see that. It's in the liturgy. It's in the thinking. It's in the theology. And so, you know, I wasn't even born then, but I can imagine as a convert, I thought I was coming into the Tridentine Church. And then I remember going to communion, and seeing people standing up with their hands out. As Anglicans, we knelt at a rail. Mm-hmm. And so then when we came to believe in transubstantiation, the praxis didn't match what I had read on paper before coming into the church. So I myself was scandalized and startled by what I thought was Catholicism, but I came in after the council. And so,
yeah, you see, again, I always want to stress that, as a cradle traditional Catholic, if you will, by the way, I'm so thrilled, I've been following you for years and that people like you are saying, something's really wrong in the church. We need to talk about this. This is fantastic. We need to, you use that expression from the old Braveheart movie, unite the clans. We need to come together. And so looking at the mass, it was never a case for us as traditionalists. Now, we go way, way back to the crucial at mass in the Howard Johnson hotels or in the basement. I'll never forget the day that my mother and father actually went and rescued a high side altar from a local church.
Wow.
And installed it in my basement back in the early 1970s. That's how bad it was. So I'm overshooting pool with my friends and there's this huge altar. that's the way it was back in the day. But it's for me, it's kind of heartbreaking because I was very good friends with guys like Michael Davies. And so you never met a more humble man than Michael Davies. We were not saying we're more Catholic than the Pope. We're better than the church. We're so spiritual that we need the Latin. We need the traditional Latin mass because we're so holy. That was never what traditional Catholics were all about. We looked at this thing, and I think you've done some shows or you've talked about this yourself. Just look at physically what happened to the mass. I mean, it used to be, this isn't a matter of preference, what I like.
Right.
I'm not that holy of a guy. If I can go in and get my Sunday obligation done in 20 minutes, fantastic. And I like to think I'm progressing away from them. That's the way it was when I was just becoming a traditionalist. So it wasn't that I was such a Latinist or a snob. You could see what they were doing. I mean, there's that beautiful, not terrifying video of Pope Paul VI removing his tiara in St. Peter's, going over to the altar, ceremoniously setting it down and walking away from it. Very soon thereafter, they turned the priests around. People say, well, I like to be able to understand the English. I like to be able to see what Father's doing. And I understand that. As Monsignor Gamber talked about that. We need to re-educate people on what the point and purpose of the Mass is. But the reality is the priest, for 1,000 years, for 1,800 years, faced God, leading the flock in the direction of God. It's all right there rubrically. And somebody at some point, now Vatican II didn't actually call for this, but somebody said, let's turn them around. Let's face the people. Let's not use the sacred language anymore. Let's use vernacular. Let's get handshaking and let's get. So you can just, even as a kid, I could see this. It's like, this is very strange. We're no longer being led by the priest in the worship of God. We're having a conversation. And you hear good priests now even saying, they say to us lay people, you have no idea how difficult it is for me, a good priest, a regular guy, during the consecration to have to womp up this holiness, display it while I'm facing the people. Whereas when they say the Latin Mass, that all disappears. His personality disappears, and he leads us in the direction of worshiping God. So these things really aren't a matter of preference. If you look carefully at what they did to the Mass, you can see a malicious hand. Not that everyone was malicious, but you can see that somebody said, we are going to radically change the Catholic Church. And of course, lex orandi, lex credendi, as you pray is how you will believe. And that's what we're seeing today. They changed the Mass. They Protestantized the Mass. And now you have Catholics, which are, for the most part, virtually indistinguishable from Protestants because of the way they've been worshiping. It's not their fault. It's right. The way they've been worshiping for 50 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you add on to that communion in the hand. And like you said, the vernacular, even the architecture, radically changed. You know, it went from cruciform to circular. You know, any church built after 1970, it's hard to find. Now people are sort of doing it. It's like a new rebel movement to have new traditional churches. But most of them were all in the round. Yeah. And the whole idea was a circular community, you know, worshiping in conversation with itself. And it wasn't transcendent. It wasn't pointing everyone towards that heavenly high altar, that reality there. So,
and it's just some like really basic stuff too that I like to share with people, you know, who've not thought about this. Really easy things, like for example, the Et Incarnatus Est, that for again over 1,000 years, at that moment of the Mass, every day throughout Christendom, every man of Christendom, every woman of Christendom took a knee, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Took a knee. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Who is the genius that decided that's too much work? We don't want people genuflecting at the Et Incarnatus Est. Let's stop doing that. They don't do anything now in the new masses. They don't even acknowledge. Just run right through it.
Right.
So I like to look at those little things to say, that isn't a little thing. Somebody, that's almost a demonic thing. Do not take a knee at the Et Incarnatus Est. Mm. Why in heaven's name not? Who wanted to make those kinds of changes?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And people will say, well, it's just a preference. You know, you like the aesthetic, you like the Latin or whatever. But when you put them side by side and you look at the rubrics and you look at the actual things said by the priest, you know, more is more and less is less. And the Novus, you look at the offertory prayers, you know, the seven offertory prayers of the traditional Mass. And then you look at what they have in the Novus Ordo. It's less. If you look at, you know, the Eucharistic prayer 2, 3, 4 and compare it to the Roman, it's less. Even when you look at the Eucharistic prayer 1 and put it up to the Roman canon, you can omit the saints as the priest runs it. It's less. So why are we chopping it away? Why are we taking what worked so well for centuries and removing it or removing even a genuflection?
Right. Why have they removed almost all now of the references to sacrifice?
Right.
Why has the sacrificial high altar been removed, busted up, and replaced by a table? Why are they doing these things if they don't, in fact, want to turn it into sort of a Protestant commemorative meal? And that we talk about the priesthood now and the mess that the priesthood is in right now. I would argue that that's largely because the priesthood really no longer has a role, because priest is for sacrifice. And we have removed sacrifice from our, not totally, I'm not one of these that says a new mass in every case is invalid and all of that, but for the most part, it's not a sacrifice anymore. It's a communal meal. The priest has no role. He sits on the side, he does his thing, you got everybody running around playing guitars and doing their thing. And increasingly, he has less and less of a role. You know, and even to make changes now, like people say, well, why doesn't Father straighten things up? I remember listening to a parish, a priest one time, who's kind of a young guy, he was trying to do the right thing. He must have spent 10 minutes in a sermon explaining why he had changed the orientation of his presider's chair from having his back to the tabernacle to having his side to the tabernacle so God is more included. And I remember feeling so sorry for this guy. Like, he had to really break it down for the folks that he was going to change his little chair, you know? Yeah. And it just was another reminder, they don't have the power anymore. The priests don't really have the power to change anymore. And then you add the doctrinal problems in the seminaries, you add in the fact that they were recruiting homosexuals to the seminary, and they destroyed the priesthood to go along with a destroyed mass. So the fact that we're still fighting is proof that that Catholics are optimistic, to say the least, you know? Because right. we know in the end, God is going to, he's going to save his church. But boy, is it ever important for Catholics to open their eyes right now and to realize where we're standing and what happened to our church so that we can defend her and so that we cannot lose the faith, because that's what they want. Look, you know the statistics as well as I, in terms of the number of Catholics who have left the church. Well, there's a problem. There's a massive problem. You have that sort of hemorrhaging of members out of the church. It isn't working. But, you know, we were in Rome a couple of weeks ago. They don't even act like it's not working. They act like everything is fine. It's like they're completely deluded. They have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, it's like, I've used it before, it's like the new Coke that came out in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wanted it. There was public outcry. Within, I think, 70 or 80 days, they went back to Coke Classic. But here we are, you know, 50 years later, and they keep saying, but no, new Coke's really better. Yeah. Like, no one's buying it. No one wants it. No one wants to drink that. Yeah, but it's better.
Yeah.
It's not.
It's not at all.
We need Catholic Classic, not the new Catholic.
I wanted to talk to some of these cardinals running around, because the really funny thing about the clerical sexual abuse summit was the other elephant. There were so many elephants in the room that they weren't touching. Of course, homosexuality was being the largest and the most obvious in the priesthood. But just basic, you know, other questions like, have you guys noticed that your churches are closing by the hundreds? Do you know that the Catholic school is becoming almost non-existent? Catholic nuns gone, except for a few butch pantsuited goofballs on the far left who are voting for Obama and Clinton and all. I mean, it's like you wonder, are they doing this on purpose, or are they really diabolically disoriented, like we get from Fatima, like they really don't see it?
Yeah.
You know, like what's his name? Cardinal Daniels died yesterday. You know, God bless his soul. But, you know, you wonder now, does Francis and company, do they look at this guy who was one of them, one of the St. Gallen's mafia? And they think now he knows everything. Now he's standing in front of the august throne of Almighty God. Do they worry, or do they think, isn't it great? He went right to the happy place because he's Cardinal Daniels. You know, that's the mystery to me. It's stupidity, arrogance, demonic obsession. What is it?
Right. You know, yeah. I followed all of your videos when you were in Rome. They're well done. And at one point you impressed me because you were standing in St. Peter's Square. And at one point you said, I think you said, we're winning. There was something optimistic like that. And you said, there will be traditional Latin masses in this building, in this church again. And you pointed back at St. Peter's. Mm-hmm. And there's an optimism there. And I like that. But, you know, in the wake of that horrible Rome summit, how can you, as a traditional Catholic, say something like that?
Oh, it's really funny because I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
I think that's the answer. In other words, and you know, you're a convert from Anglicanism. I'm not sure how long you've been in a Catholic church, but it didn't take you long to say, wait a minute, something's wrong here. You know, something's gone wrong in the human element of the church. And that, to me, is where my optimism now comes from, because you have no idea how difficult it was during the 80s. You know, for example, when everything seemed great, John Paul's on the throne, Maggie Thatcher's the prime minister, you know, Ronald Reagan's the president. Everything seemed to be working in the 80s. So it made it very difficult to say, hello, you know, I'm a little Catholic counter-revolutionary. It ain't what it seemed. You looked like a crazy person back in the 80s. Well, now that's all come crashing down. What Chris Farrar calls the great facade has come crashing down. And again, I don't know if Pope Francis is doing it on purpose or not, but he's jumping the shark every day. So the optimism comes from, oh my gosh, when we really thought back in the day when we were having masses in hotels and in basements because we couldn't find, you know, everything was going so crazy. We never would have thought that there would come a time when we would have like a Pope Benedict, for example. He, despite his, you know, some of the things that we disagree with Pope Benedict, that he would bring back the Latin Mass and essentially exonerate those poor guys that gave up everything for the traditional Mass back in the 60s, you know, that he would bring it back and say it had never been abrogated. That now you're standing in St. Peter's. Like I said, people were misunderstanding me. I was actually talking to this reporter from CNN. Of course, I don't have anything in agreement with the CNN people, but I thought this is interesting that even mainstream media people are looking at Supich and company and the little show that they put on over there, and they're literally shaking their head, who do these people think they're fooling? I mean, they were in the press hall, the Vatican press hall, I would say that they were this close to mocking the cardinals of the church. They were so just obviously seeing through what was going on there. So that's where, I mean, I hate to say that because it is in the same time. So people say, how's the remnant doing? And I say, it's doing really good. I should probably write a letter of thanks to Pope Francis. So it's good for the Catholic resistance. It's in a sense, it's bad for Mother Church because it means things are really, really bad. But you asked about optimism and it comes from this idea that I think right now, I don't want to exaggerate, but I would say hundreds of thousands of Catholics are waking up. And that to me is just like divine providence. Somehow they made it through the rain. They kept the faith despite the felt banners and the John Denver music and all the insanity. They made it through. And all of a sudden, tradition is coming back. And young priests are, you know, putting the cassock on again and saying a Latin Mass. This to me seems to be absolute providence. Is what guys like Michael Davies and Archbishop Lefebvre predicted would happen. In God's good time, the faith would come back. We had to do what the Catholics in the Western Uprising in England did. It's the Mass that matters. Hang on to the old faith. No matter what, hang on, because eventually, if we hang on, God's going to come to the rescue. And I think that's what's happening right now. We're going to have to go through some tough times with this guy, Francis, because he's out there like a planet. Let's face it. I don't know what he's doing anymore. But people are seeing through it, and praise God for that. I think now we can begin with the serious business of Catholic restoration.
Yeah. I mean, myself, I've attended the Latin Mass for almost 10 years now. And, you know, I first got into it. It was, you know, other Catholics look down their nose at you or like some of the things you said earlier, you know, think you're more holy or whatever. But I was also unaware of the origins of this movement, and in particular with Archbishop Lefebvre. And I'm reading his biography. Right now, and I'm very impressed with his spirituality. But one of the things that I find very interesting was the whole struggle in the late 70s and into the 80s in the traditional movement. And like you said, it's been exonerated by Pope Benedict XVI, who's lifted the excommunications. And it said that the Mass was never abrogated, but it sure looked like it was. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, before 84 and those years, I mean, what was that like? I mean, I guess your family was part of that.
Yeah,
Paint a picture for us. What was that like in the 80s?
Sure. Yeah, I was actually confirmed by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre.
You were?
Yeah, I'm very proud of that. I knew him. I was just a kid, but I mean, I got to meet him and I remember him and everything else. And again, I'm so glad you're bringing this stuff up. Matter of fact, you say you're reading about Archbishop Lefebvre. You're interviewing me. I should get you to write for the Remnant. I mean, that's if you have that sort of open-mindedness where you're like, what really happened?
Right.
Then essentially that's what the Remnant's been all along. And that's what we were. As far with respect to the Society of St. Pius X, and whenever I talk about the Society, I'm not a member. Only a priest can be a member of the Society. I go to the local diocesan traditional Latin Mass here, and I always have in St. Paul. So I'm not a spokesman for the Society, but I lived through it, and I knew a lot of people who had a tremendous amount of respect for Archbishop Lefebvre. And today, to this day, you know, you can say, well, I think he should have obeyed. I think that his job was just to suffer under the administration, under the pontificate, and obey and not consecrate bishops as he did in 1988. You know what? That's a perfectly fair argument, and we can all have that argument. But if you look at him and you don't see a man who was a modern-day Athanasius trying to do the best he could possibly, if you see an arrogant person, for example, this man was the picture of humility. It broke his heart. It devastated him to turn against the church, against the Vatican, because he had been, you know, he was the favored son of Pope Pius XII. He was one of the most successful missionaries of the 20th century. He gave his life for the church, as did his entire family. His father died in a Nazi concentration camp. You know, he's got sisters who are nuns, priests who are brothers who are priests. This is a beautiful, beautiful family. And to for one second think that what he was doing was based, you know, was motivated by personal arrogance or ambition is so myopic. And I just don't have any patience for it anymore. He did the best he can. He could. You could say, well, he shouldn't have done what he, okay, fine. But the reality is he changed history. Michael Davies made this point over and over again, because as I just told you, you know, we remember the masses in the basements in the hotels. We weren't changing history, Taylor. We really weren't. We're hanging on by our fingertips. None of us were delusional enough to think, well, we're going to save the church. That wasn't it. My parents were simply trying to raise their kids so they could keep the faith. The one who changed history was Archbishop Lefebvre, because he was in a position to do so. He is a council father. He signed the documents of Vatican II. He was there, right? So when he finally did what he did, he was speaking from experience and from knowledge. He knew who had taken over in the Vatican. And he did everything he possibly could. If you read his books, you can see where he's not trying to break from Rome. It's the last thing he ever envisioned happening. But when things got so bad, he believed that his first job was to preserve and save the faith. And so he did what he thought was best. He's a human being. I need to consecrate bishop. And you know what? He was dead a couple years later. So he wasn't far off the mark. He knew he didn't have long. He had to do something. The Vatican was playing games with him. And if you look at what's happened since 1988 in the Vatican, how can you not say that Lefebvre obviously saw the beast and he was onto something, you know? And he did change history. What's been beautiful about the society since is the fact that they never did what we feared they would do. My father didn't go along with Archbishop Lefebvre in 1988. As a Catholic journalist, he said, oh, no way, I can't do this. He supported him. He was the first one to actually organize a reception for Archbishop Lefebvre in the United States in 1976. So he was always a supporter. In 1988, he cut with Archbishop Lefebvre. He said, I'm sorry, I love you, but I can't go along with this. And it wasn't until a few years later that everything began to unfold and everyone began to understand why Archbishop Lefebvre had done what he did. And then the remnant, you know, went back and started saying, you know what, he was right. Okay, so here we go. We're all going to be on the try to unite the clans and be on the same page here and fight. So that's, I think that's in a nutshell, if people, your listeners could just do the research, read the book, and just realize that this was an incredibly humble man of God, a man of the church who did the very best he could. And since then, I started to say earlier, since then, you can see he never did what those were worried about, what they called the petite église at the time. And he would start his own church and he would consecrate his own pope. Absolutely nothing even close like that ever happened. In fact, for people who are paying attention to the society, probably the most criticism they get right now is that they've been too cozy with the Vatican. They've worked too hard to make sure they do not create the perception of schism and so forth. To their credit, I think they're doing a great job. So they've not left the church. They're still there. They're still working on their irregular canonical status. And they've helped millions of people then, whether it's because of the spin-offs like the Fraternity of St. Peter, a huge supporter of the Fraternity of St. Peter, Institute of Christ the King, all the diocesan guys. From that one act in 1988, we had a serious serious Catholic counter-revolution that formed because of what Lefebvre did. So I'm going to go to my grave saying, thank God for Archbishop Lefebvre.
Yeah. I initially, when I came into, you know, attending the Latin Mass, I honestly said Lefebvre was just like a Luther. That was my initial take on him. And since then, I've become very interested in the history of the Second Vatican Council. I've been reading it, and I'm like, who during the council were the open voices? Who were the Athanasius at the council? And Ottaviani and Lefebvre, his name comes up over it. Every single thing in counter movement and changing the language or protesting things in the document, Lefebvre. He's there over and over and over. And then when the new mass is coming out, again, the intervention happens. Who organizes that? Lefebvre.
Then
into the 70s, you know, who starts training priests? Lefebvre. And then the 80s, you know, when John Paul II, you know, when he's receiving the ashes from the Hindus and he's, you know, going to the animist rites in Africa and going into Lutheran churches and into synagogues. And then finally in 86 is Assisi. In 86, he has Assisi. And there's, you know, Native Americans smoking their peace pipes and there's Buddha on the tabernacle and all this nonsense, right? Who's the one issuing a public statement saying this is apostasy? Lefebvre. And he was right. And so I'm reading through this. You can't read the history and the name Lefebvre just keeps popping up every single year on every single horrible thing happening in the church. And so I finally just have to admit, Lefebvre's the good guy in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the ADA thing is controversial, but I think we're kind of beyond that, and we can unite the clans. But when you look at Lefebvre's baseball card and you turn it over and look at his stats, he has remarkable stats.
Right. And really, even 88, I always think if people would just set aside, because a lot of this is personal, and I understand that. Families were divided over this. Some people went society, some didn't. So I understand that. And like I say, there's a certain beautiful thing about I'm always going to stay in the bosom of the church and obey. That's basically a Catholic idea. The problem is we've never gone through a period of revolution like this, of upheaval like this. So you know, if you look at Lefebvre and why he did what he did, it wasn't first and foremost the Mass. It was Assisi. That's what did it. It was 1986 that caused 1988. And what we're seeing today now, especially, is it's just a continuation of Assisi. I just did a video the other day. Couldn't believe I'd never seen this video of John Paul standing at the memorial spot of Mahatma Gandhi, calling him a hero of humanity, and saying that if we follow the ideas of Gandhi, we will build, and I'm not kidding you, a new world order. Now, I thought this is Snopes. I'm going to Snopes this and find out. This is crazy. I went to the Vatican's website. The whole transcript is right there. So this is another thing to blame.
And it says New World Order.
New World Order.
John Paul II.
Yes. Yeah. Look it up. So then
And what year was that?
This was in, 86. So 86. You know, you see that happening. And that's another thing where I get a little frustrated with some of our friends that are blaming Francis for everything, because Francis is basically just continuing. I realize he's worse than John. I mean, John Paul had the faith. John Paul was, there was something about him.
Yeah, he wore the scapular. I mean, he was
more cosmopolitan. Yeah. You know, there's something likable and dynamic about him. So I get it. You know, Francis, I think he speaks like 1.5 languages. He just doesn't strike me as this. Anyway, that's petty. But in any case, he's doing John Paul very, very badly when it comes to ecumenism. There's no doubt about it. He's doing the same thing. So the jamborees, the things that he had with the Egyptian imam a couple of weeks ago, that's all in the spirit of Assisi. It's the same kind of thing. So I think it really is important right now for us not to just say, well, now Pope Francis, now he's bad. So now I'm going to become part of this Catholic counter-revolution. Then you got to say, that's not fair to Francis. You got to say Francis needs to be attached to the whole revolution that Archbishop Lefebvre was fighting against, because it's pretty clear what was going on. And Francis is just a clumsy sort of continuation of that. It's all going in the same direction. I don't know what you think about that. I just don't think it's fair to say everything was great until 2013 when Francis was elected. To me, that doesn't make any sense. It seems unfair to the man.
Right. Well, I converted to Catholicism under Benedict XVI. Never lived a day under John Paul II. So I kind of had a facade. You know, looking back now, I realize that life under Benedict XVI was in many ways a facade. So when Francis came, it was a black and white change for me in my own history. And that's what led me, you know, I was already in the Latin Mass, but that's what led me to try to figure out why is this happening? Like, I got to go back and read the documents of Vatican II. I got to look at the notes, you know, look at the minutes, who was saying what, which parties were there, which cardinals were in favor of these things, who were the ghostwriters on these documents. And that's when I began to realize that Lefebvre, you know, I only knew Lefebvre SSPX 1988. That's all I knew. And then looking back in these documents, I realized this movement is not just about the Latin Mass.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's not just about a feud between Lefebvre and John Paul in 1988.
Right.
This is a multi-decade resistance that has to do with originally theology, later liturgy.
Yeah, it's so important. I'm so glad you're bringing out the actual documents of Vatican II. It's what we have to do. We have to go back and look at them, because Lefebvre signed. There's a controversy over how many of the documents that he signed. Personally, I think he signed them all with reservations, but he signed most of them. And he's the one that he and Michael Davies came up with this term, time bombs of Vatican II, that they had. I think it's important to realize that, because if you have a really fair-minded person who's just going to take the documents of Vatican II and just read them on the face completely out of the context of everything else that has happened, many things in Vatican II are very nice, very beautiful. Matter of fact, you and I probably accept more that's doctrinally binding in Vatican II than the vast majority of modern priests out there. Or rejecting everything, and now they're starting to mess around with contraception and moral issues and everything else. We actually accept much of Vatican II, that which was binding, which was reiterating previous church teaching. So those things are in there. But what you have to look at in Vatican II is the time bombs. What were they actually, how was this going to be interpreted later on? And Lefebvre knew that. So he's like, that's why that was the basis of his reservations. If this is interpreted in light of tradition somehow, we might be okay. If modernists get a hold of this, it's going to be all hell breaking loose, which is precisely what happened. So the time bombs are what's relevant. The spirit, I always say to people, I don't even care about it. It's the spirit of Vatican II that we're against, because that was the whole reorientation of the church, the whole change of the Catholic Church. And that's what Lefebvre was against, and that's what the traditionalists were against all along. And that spirit of Vatican II is represented perfectly in the liturgy of the new mass, and the changes of the new mass. It is all one, but you're so right. This has not been just an issue, a revolution over there, a counter-revolution over the liturgical issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Schilbeck who said that we placed ambiguity in the council documents and we knew how we would interpret them later on.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they did. You know, they founded the journal Concilium right after the council, and they just started reinterpreting or interpreting the documents that they had written and influenced and composed, and took them to these radical liberal positions with Kuhn, Schilbeck, these guys, and then, you know, guys like Ratzinger and, you know, people that nowadays people say are conservative but aren't really, you know, like Balthazar and de Lubach and whatnot. They sort of like, let's tap the brakes, guys, because y'all are denying the virgin birth and you're denying transubstantiation, you're denying Vatican I. And so they, you know, they did their own journal, Communio, and that's kind of what became mainstream in the 80s and in the 90s under John Paul II. That was considered conservative. Yeah. But then you have this whole other movement, which is the traditionalist movement, which is, it's natural that it got wrapped up with the identity of the liturgy. That was the banner.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important for people to see moving forward, especially under Francis, that it's not the banner, the Latin Mass, that's not the only thing. Have to go back to Thomism. We have to go back to our traditional moral theology of Alphonsus Liguori. We have to recapture all these things. The Latin Mass has all that built into it. But we have to realize that you just can't switch the Mass and fix everything.
Right.
This is deeply embedded.
It's a very, very important point. For one thing, what was the Mass throughout the Roman Rite, throughout the world in 1965 at the close of the Second Vatican Council? Traditional Latin Mass.
Yeah.
So it's not a magic potion that's just going to fix everything. And that's, you know, that's very true. That it's more than the Mass. The Mass, I like it, especially for young people. I like the idea of rallying around the old Mass, because there's beautiful moments in history. The Vendée in France in 18th century, in the late 1780s in France. The Western uprising in England, where you had Catholics, literally their slogan was, it's the Mass that matters. And it's a beautiful thing. And this is like the Shark Pilgrimage. Everybody's just around that whole idea. Bring back our Mass. You stole it from us. We want it back. And so it's a beautiful rallying cry. It's a beautiful thing to bring. And it does defend, because it is so bulletproof. That's the beauty of the Latin. It defends the doctrines and the dogmas as well, because you can't tinker with it like they do with the Novus Ordo, with the vernacular languages. I just think it's really important to put it all in perspective. It's very, very important, but it's not everything. This is a doctrinal revolution. It's also a liturgical revolution. It's the same. But there is a certain myopic, and some newcomers to tradition think it's just the Latin Mass and everything else is fine. I don't agree. That's just the starting point. And then you work back and you realize, oh my gosh, this is Pius X was warning against this stuff in 1907. So for people to say, well, it's the Vatican Council that's the whole thing, that's it all started. Before 1965, everything was great. Well, then St. Pius X was delusional, right? Because he's frantically trying to warn the world that the church had been infiltrated in her heart and bosom by these guys, by these modernists. So obviously, I always try to dispel that when people think the traditionalists believe it. We do not believe that. Right. It's going to be some of the more ignorant wing of tradition does, but not at all. Pius X is the patron saint of traditional Catholic counter-revolution. He was talking 60 years before Vatican II that there was a massive doctrinal revolution in the church. So I agree with you. Everything has to be put in perspective, slow down, sit back, read, study, figure out what happened to your church, and then decide you're going to intelligently go out there and do something about it. Mainly, by going back to tradition and keeping the faith.
Yeah, it's an infiltration. I'm writing a book right now. The working title is Infiltration, and it's showing that this happened. It was a 200-year plot. It goes back to the mid to early 1800s with secret societies, which then infiltrate the church through modernism, liberalism, then modernism. And then, I mean, that was all party prep. The parade, the party was Vatican II. That was the coming out party.
Absolutely. But
they had been prepping this for decades, going back into even the mid-1800s, before the fall of the Papal States. They had been prepping this and laying the foundation for a theological revolution way long ago. So it's not just the Vatican II.
Exactly. Doesn't it make you kind of proud to be a Catholic? To me, it makes you so proud to be a Catholic to look back on this history of revolution now and say, man, they were at this for a long time. I mean, it literally took centuries to bring the Catholic Church to the low level that she's at right now because of how powerful she is, you know?
That's right.
And she's because of the divine and human nature of the church. But it is interesting how far back it goes. Like, I'm not a monarchist, quote unquote. I certainly wouldn't mind if suddenly everything changed and we had Catholic kings again. But I always find it kind of disheartening to find people who are good on the mass issue. Liturgically, it's like, yeah, we need to go back to tradition. And then take a very Americanist, anti-monarchy approach to Christendom. Because I go, no, you can't. You can't get a good idea of what's happened to the Catholic Church if you have an inaccurate idea of what Christendom was, which was this beautiful, you know, social kingship of Christ model that actually worked for a long time and built the greatest civilization ever. So to be anti-monarchy or anti-Christendom and not realize that they went through these same people, these same entities coming out of the Enlightenment, came through and literally beheaded Catholic Europe. They killed the kings and queens. They got rid of the monarchy. And then they started on the liturgy later on towards the end of the 20th, beginning of the 20th century. It's all part of the same thing. Yep. They had to destroy the church. And they're doing a pretty good job at this point.
Yep. So how do we unite the clans? I mean, I've been in the Latin mass circles for definitely not as long as you have, but a little bit, you know, and you've got, you know, three camps come to mind. You've got your very conservative Novus Ordo Catholic. This is a lot of stalwart bishops and even cardinals. You know, I'm thinking of like a Athanasius Schneider or a Cardinal Burke. They like the Latin mass. They celebrate it in public. But, you know, they're still within the primary diocesan structure and are celebrating most of their sacramental ministry in the new rites. And they give the idea, you know, that Vatican II, we can interpret it in light of tradition. I mean, the mascot for this position, I think, is Benedict XVI. These are your B16 Catholics, right? And then you've got sort of your fraternity, your what was Ecclesia Dei. You know, you got your fraternity, your institute people, and then you've got your society of St. Pius X people. And these seem to be the three primary clans. Is there something I'm missing?
I would throw diocesan guys in there.
Okay.
There's an awful lot of diocesan young priests that are waking up right now. I personally just take a lot of hope and comfort in the fact that they're waking up. There's a lot of them. They're under the radar a little bit, but they're fighting hard. So I put a fourth category.
Yeah, would you say those diocesans are interested in celebrating the Latin Mass or just are waking up? Where would you put them?
It just depends on which ones, but there are some who are very interested, in fact, already are learning the traditional mass or already are saying it. And then there are others. This is maybe a partly to answer your question about uniting the clans. This idea of how do you define traditionalists? Now, personally, I'd like to get rid of traditionalists. I want it just to be Catholic again, but as you know, that's very difficult.
Right.
You know, Nancy Pelosi is a Catholic, for heaven's sake. So yeah, you almost have to, you know, put these qualifiers in. I'd like to get rid of traditionalists for the moment. It's expedient. We keep it. But there are, especially priests, there are a lot of priests out there who I would consider tradition-minded. Now, I get in trouble with some of my you know, critics on the hardcore traditionalist critics for saying this. Oh, if they say the new mass, they're the enemy. They're bad. I don't agree, because we always talk about diabolical disorientation, as Our Lady says to Sister Lucia of Fatima. We're all to one extent or another impacted by that disorientation. So I think it's unfair to say, well, until you're an absolute card-carrying traditionalist, I will have nothing to do with you, Father. Because there's a lot of priests who are really fed up. They're tired with what's happening. They're suffering more than some of the diocese, some of the fraternity of St. Peter guys or the Society of St. Pius X guys. They're really suffering because they're in the belly of the beast. But they are fellow followers. I don't know, or fellow travelers. I don't know if you hear from these guys. I hear from them all the time in my newspaper.
I get emails and texts from these guys almost daily.
It's just, you know, that's where we go.
And I get so much from diocesans, and I get a ton from seminarians, and they say to me, what should I do? And I say, right. Let me tell you, I'm talking to about 24 priests who are ordained in the last 10 years, and it's really hard for them. Think twice about continuing into the diocesan priesthood.
Absolutely.
Because these guys are suffering.
They're suffering a lot. And so I think one of the easiest things we can do as traditionalists, I don't know if you identify as a trad or not at this point, but I mean, I'm a traditionalist.
I like what you say. I'd rather just be a Catholic, but it's expedient to say traditionalists. So I use
it. One of the easiest things we can do is put a... You know, let people know that we're trying to build, that we're trying to unite the clans. Make that part of what we do. I get very, you know, frustrated with people who are identifying as traditionalists, and they're the most offensive people. I'm sorry, but they are. I mean, if you don't agree with me on everything, well, damn you. You know, you're not good for anything, and nothing to do with you. This is a really dangerous position. Because, like I say, if you actually believe Our Lady of Fatima that there's a diabolical disorientation, well, you'd better anticipate that. You need to help people who are disoriented. She's not saying they're demonically possessed. She's saying they're disoriented. So if we have some clarity by the grace of God as far as what's happened to our church and how we need to raise our kids, and I'm guessing you're a homeschool dad, I am. We're doing all this stuff because we have been given the grace of clarity, not because we're better than everybody else, but because whatever reason, we got some clarity. But we have an obligation to try to lead people to Christ, to lovingly lead people back into the fold of tradition, to unite those clans. And so waiting for Father to become, you know, an absolute card-carrying traditionalist before we will have anything to do with him, when we know in his heart, he's reading The Remnant, he's following Taylor Marshall, he's reading Marate Chaley, he's, you know what I mean? He's like, he's a trad at heart. He just doesn't know how to do it yet. He's got 300 families in his parish. He doesn't want to abandon them. So he's trying to come our way. Well, only a fool would find a way of blocking this man. So I think that's
right.
Something we can start doing right away. Open it up a little bit. Bring these people in. We're not going to be tainted. Everybody sees the problem now in the church. We got many more allies than we've ever had. And I've been at this for 34. Never had so many allies as we have right now in this fight for Catholic restoration. So that's great.
Yeah. What would you say to those priests? I mean, what's the path forward? I mean, I'm not a priest. I mean, I was an Anglican priest before I became a Catholic, but I'm not a Catholic priest. And, you know, I don't know what to tell them. You know, I know a lot of them are saying the 1962 missal, you know, on Tuesdays and Thursdays privately, or they're saying it. Some of them are doing a 2 p.m. Sunday. You know, they've put it out in the public. So most of these priests I talk to are, yeah, I'm either saying the Latin Mass, the 62 missal privately, or I'm trying to, you know, add it once a week to my parish. Is that the right path forward? I mean, what do we tell these guys? What do
they actually do? I think it is the right path forward, because I think that, you know, everybody has a place. This is what I've always been arguing ever since, I guess, 96, when I really kind of threw in with the whole idea that it was in God's providence that you had the Society of St. Pius X and the Fraternity of St. Peter. I've never been involved in that fight. I've always tried to keep the remnant out of that, because I believe there's a role for both. There's a role for the guys, and not outside is the wrong word, but a little bit outside the wall. They're firing away. They're banging away, trying to get through. And then you got the guys as a fraternity men who've sort of got into the inside more. They need a special consideration from all of us. They can't say everything the Society of St. Pius X priests can say, for example. That doesn't mean they're cowardly. Edmund Campion wasn't a coward because he refused to denounce Elizabeth from the London Bridge every day.
Right.
He put on disguises and he pretended like he wasn't even a priest so he could continue the fight until they finally caught up with him. So I think everyone has a role in this Catholic counter-revolution, and we could learn to appreciate everybody's role. So the chance of your question, the diocesan priest, he's doing what he can. And I think we need to let him know we got your back. Got your back. Do what you can. We understand you can't do everything right away. But at least go, you know, you got some men in your parish who are going to back every move you do in favor of tradition. He's human like anybody else.
Right.
So if he knows that he's going to have some support, and we see this happening all over the place now, he's going to have support and he's going to start saying the Latin Mass, even if he can't right away, but he lets it be known that he wants to and he's learning. That's when you start bringing him into our fires. You know, that's where we start getting this guy closer, because he's going to be part of the problem, part of the solution eventually, not the problem. It's just kind of a common sense approach. Take everybody and say, okay, what's your role in this? As long as you see primarily, fundamentally, something has gone wrong and there's been a takeover of the Catholic Church and the human element. I think we need to find a way to work with everybody who sees that and then be a little patient in how we get them into the whole traditionalist thing liturgically.
Yeah. You know, it seems that, you know, we want to unite the clans, but I've also been thinking, and I haven't ever talked about this publicly, but I've been thinking about also how Pope Francis and that whole St. Gallen Mafia group also wants to unite the clans to destroy us, right? Put them all in one church and then burn the church down, right? I mean, do you think that the overtures that have been very generous so far by Pope Francis, and I'm thinking towards the Society of St. Pius X, what's the intention behind that? I mean, in the Year of Mercy, he gave them faculties. He extended those since then. I've heard that, you know, Bishop Fillet has said that he has permission to ordain now in other ordinaries' dioceses, which they always did before, but now they apparently have some sort of permission. There's now a setup for marriages to be enrolled at the diocesan registry. I mean, so some of these things are happening under Francis, and you think that would have been Benedict doing that, but it's Francis. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, you would have to bring that up. We were steering clear of the big controversy, at least in the tradi field.
Right.
I think that this is where I get in a little trouble, because I don't think now is the right time for the society to sign any sort of make any kind of arrangement with the pontificate of Pope Francis. I just don't trust him. I'm sorry.
Right, but under B16, you would have, right?
I think so. As long as everything was really careful, here's what I would have at the time. I was saying, if they really got legal representation and did it right. See, I don't trust the Vatican.
Yep.
I just don't trust even Pope Benedict. Remember what he said, famously said, to, I think it was to Bishop Fillet. He said, my power ends at the door. He pointed to the door of his office. My power ends there.
Yeah.
So that they would want to take the most powerful force of Catholic priests, order of Catholic priests in the world today, and undermine them, take them out of the fight. To me, if I'm writing a novel, and I'm the Pope, that's the main thing I'm going to do. Take those priests out. That's like another order of Jesuits. They could change the world, the Society of St. Pius of 10. So that's going to be priority number one, take them out.
Yeah.
And whether it's excommunication or whether it's bringing them a little closer, you know, and seduce them and Romanitas and all of this, and now you're part of us in Rome and all, they don't care how they do it.
Right.
And I'm not saying that I know they're doing this. My concern is that that's what's happening. So my advice to my friends in the society, to the extent that they listen to me, and it's, I'm not in the society, but I always say, let's just wait a little longer. I don't think Francis is, and I think the society is basically at that point. They've done a beautiful job demonstrating that they're not in schism. That pretty much any time the Vatican calls, the society representatives run over to Rome and have a meeting. This is not the behavior of schismatics. So I actually think the society is doing a pretty good job.
The Sede Vacantis make fun of them all the time on this.
Oh, man, yeah. Sellouts. Yeah. So, I think right now things are working. And again, looking back over my history growing up, I never would have thought that we would be to the point now where you have, you know, traditional Latin masses in pretty much every major city in the United States. Holy mackerel. I mean, I don't understand how incredible that is, considering how dead it was in the 1970s, how stupid it was to even ever imagine the Latin mass coming back. So we've seen the hand of God, and I think we've seen the hand of God working through these orders of priests, you know, the approved Ecclesia Dei and the Society of St. Pius X, working together, because the society keeps the fraternity, if you think about it, from going by ritual and all that, like we saw in the 90s, that almost happened. And the fraternity holding the line and continuing to be traditional, even if they don't blast away at Vatican II. I've never asked them to do that. They don't sit in the pulpit and get all, you know, all off on Vatican II. They can't. Fine. Whatever. They find other ways of getting that message through. But the fact that they've stayed traditional has also, I think, kept the society close. Because if the fraternity had gone crazy, you know, by ritual, everybody would have said to the society, see, this is what happens.
Right.
Stay away completely.
Yeah.
But they didn't. So to me, I see providence, and I see the hand of God in that, that both these large order of priests are kind of keeping each other progressing in the right direction of Catholic restoration. I think it's providential. I wouldn't mind if it stays that way for a bit longer.
So you think that, because some people, depending, there is rivalry, I will admit it, you know, in the FSSP and the SSPX, and both some people in each think the other shouldn't exist. So you're actually proposing that it's in part of the divine wisdom that they're tethered together on either side of the
absolutely.
Of the faith. Yeah, interesting.
It takes us and our petty little attitude out of it. God's working on this.
Yeah.
And I say to my friends, you know, you don't, as a Fraternity of St. Peter faithful, please don't go to your priest and say, is it okay if I go to the Society of St. Pius the 10th Masses? I mean, come on. You know what he's going to say. You know, yeah. Don't put him on that spot. The same with the society people. Is it okay if I go to the fraternity? No. It all boils down to what is a state of emergency. We have this in the Code of Canon Law. It exists for a reason. So it is somewhat subjective. Are we in a state of emergency or are we not? Were we in a state of emergency in 1988 or were we not? So there is some debate in there. So the two sides, one side says, I think we can handle this. We're going to be obedient. We're going to continue the Latin Mass. The other says, no, we can't trust these guys. This is a state of emergency. We need to do something dramatic. That's a legitimate debate. You don't have to necessarily solve it right now. That's just, these are the times in which we live. And so I think, you know, as Catholics, we just got to be a little bit more patient and a little less, I've got it all figured out.
Yeah.
Because we don't.
Yeah.
We don't have it all figured out. This is a really, really dangerous time.
Yeah. What do you think about, there's kind of been a renaissance in these circles with Thomism, with, you know, rediscovering, you know, the manuals, which were so, you know, put down as, you know, in pejorative language. But also, I've been really curious about this new appreciation, love, and move for the pre-Bugnini, pre-1955 Holy Week, which we're starting to see more widely. And it was allowed by the Holy See. I think it was last year, wasn't it? 2017, it was allowed. Any thoughts on that? I mean, this is even going beyond Lefebvre at this point.
Yeah, it's one of those things I don't really understand. I don't understand why that is. If it's just it's an anomaly, it's something fun to play with, to go back to. I mean, those were some very lengthy, you know, services. You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's a reason behind it or if it's just something to try out. Because, you know, there is a certain sense now where Catholics, you see this when you go to Rome, where everyone dresses like a priest. I mean, as soon as they get there, I guess they unpack their costumes in the hotel and everybody's all cassocked up. Yeah. And it looks like 1950, you know. So I think there is a certain sense now where Catholics are saying, well, look at these Muslims. They're all identifying as Muslims. They're getting fanatical. They're doing all this stuff. But man, are they proud of their religion. And Catholics said, like, you know, glory and praise. We got nothing going on. You know, we want to have a little bit more of a virile identity as Catholics. And I think we're seeing that in priests who want to dress as priests again. Yeah. And maybe some of this liturgical stuff as well, where people are saying, they kind of robbed us of our stuff. You know, we want to go back and on our big Holy Week, on our big feasts, we want to have what was inherently Catholic.
Yeah.
And so maybe, but why the Vatican is not dragging its feet on that, I don't know. Maybe it's for them is they don't have that much to lose.
Right.
And it makes them look, you know, magnanimous. I don't know. I really don't.
What do you think about the idea that the Holy See, current Vatican administration, just sort of wants to bring us all together? Right. And maybe even push everybody towards the society. I've been hearing people now saying this would be in fraternity circles. Well, the reason that the SSPX is getting these privileges is they're about to dump everybody into. They want to unite everybody in a quasi in communion situation. Just kind of treat them like an Eastern Orthodox church and kind of just have them out. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm concerned that could be. Mm-hmm. And I want to be really clear. I've got no inside baseball. I don't know anything. I'm concerned that it could be because it makes sense.
Yeah.
I think what they want, this is what you see when they've just been fanatical ever since 88. Society must accept Vatican II. What does that even mean? You know, what are they talking about? What doctrines does the society need to, you know, sign on the bottom line with respect to prove that they are Catholic? What are we talking about here?
Right.
I mean, the Vatican will not even tell the society what it is that they must sign on to in order to become in full communion with the Pope. So what is with this, you must accept Vatican II thing? It makes no sense to me. I think what they're saying is you have to accept the spirit of the new church. That's what they're worried about.
Right.
They're worried that someone is going to keep the old spirit of Christ the King, social kingship of Christ, traditional Latin Mass, traditional doctrine, Thomism, keep it all alive somewhere so that when this whole thing blows up, this Church of Accompaniment blows up, there's going to be the Catholic Church left to blossom and come back up like the phoenix.
Yeah.
I think that they're worried about that. But if they can just take us all, co-opt us, shut us up, make sure we don't You know, we don't step out of line. Like Abbe Danat said years ago, they will give us the mass as long as we swallow the council. Right. And I'm concerned that, that could be what they want. They want to take us, put us in our own little right, where we're going to be so happy. Because who bites the hand that feeds them?
Right.
If all of a sudden the society is made so legitimate and everything else, yeah. It's difficult to continue to fight people who are now your beneficiaries.
That's right.
But the reality is, within the context of loyal opposition inside the church, we need to continue to fight them. Because what they're doing is not Catholic anymore. So we don't just need to be legitimized. We need to be counter-revolutionary. I really believe this. We need to continue the fight. Now, it's easy for us as lay people to do it. We don't have as much to lose. But ultimately, we need priests to continue the fight. And this is why it bothers me when people say, well, the fraternity doesn't attack the society, doesn't attack Vatican II or the new mass enough. I don't have any problem with that. I'm not saying you have to be crazy all the time and just always saying everything. Find other ways to undermine what's happening. But make sure you're undermining what's going on in the church. You know, that's kind of where I'm at. So, yeah. Makes me nervous when we start hearing about put all the traditionalists in your own little sort of Opus Dei thing and let it all sit out there where it can be controlled. I don't want to be controlled like that by the Vatican.
Yeah. You know, there's the quote that Lefebvre, you know, he's insistent on this. And a lot of people, you know, they get red-pilled and they hear this. But Pope Paul VI, the day before the council closed, December 7, 1965, he said, quote, "The magisterium of the church did not wish to pronounce itself under the form of extraordinary dogmatic pronouncements." And then a few months later, he said, "In view of the pastoral nature of the council, it has avoided proclaiming in an extraordinary manner any dogma carrying the mark of infallibility." So this raises the question, like you just said, okay, well, if Paul VI, who's the one who ratified this council, said it did not, you know, proclaim any extraordinary manner of dogma that didn't carry the mark of infallibility, what are you asking us to accept?
Wouldn't you love to know?
It should be nothing.
Yeah. And the fact that they won't specify is really interesting.
Yeah.
Why won't they specify exactly what they mean by this? Because again, in terms of what is dogmatic, what is a reiteration of previous church teaching in the 16 documents of Vatican II, Society of St. Pius X accepts a lot more of that than most priests today. So what actually are we talking about? We're talking about sort of an ephemeral thing. I think we're talking about the spirit of Vatican II, which even, you know, Benedict XVI finally, before he left, even he condemned it. He called it the media council or whatever he tried to make it, you know, fit into that thing. But even he said, this is not what we wanted. This is the media, the council of the media, the virtual council, he called it. This was on February 14th, I think, of 2013. I don't know. Yeah, 2013. But in any case, he says this is a virtual council, the council of the media. It closed the seminaries. It destroyed the liturgy in many ways. So he's talking about the council that everyone knew, that everyone saw, that everyone experienced. But he says that's not the one we wanted. So I actually jumped on that because it's like, I'm not going to criticize him for saying that because actually it's useful to us.
Right.
That's the only council we know is the one that supposedly the big, bad, evil media manipulated.
Right.
That's the only one we know. So when they say to the Society of St. Pius, you must accept Vatican II, are they talking about the virtual council that Benedict XVI condemned, the spirit of the council, or are they talking about the documents themselves? If they're talking about the documents themselves, please tell the Society which doctrines they're deviating from in Vatican II that they need to sign on to in order to become real Catholics. Right. Their failure to do so gives them away.
Yeah, that's the big problem.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we got to get the uniting of the clans. What does that look like? Is it pilgrimages? Is it conferences? Is it just people intermarrying from these communities? I mean, what do we do to unite the clans? Is it make a YouTube video?
Again, I think we try to get away personally. We try to go back to spirituality, to humility. I mean, I'm talking about genuine humility. Understand diabolical disorientation, that we may have it wrong personally, that we're just guys trying to do the best we can, trying to raise our kids and do the right thing and fight for Mother Church as whenever we can. So I think it looks like that, becoming better Catholics, but also staying on as warriors. I hate the idea that if you become spiritual, now you become a wimp and you're no longer a soldier of Christ. Mother Church calls us to be soldiers of Christ, so let's do that. In terms of what it looks like, I think we have some models that are very useful. I think the pilgrimage to Chartres in France is just a brilliant model, and that's been going on forever. I've been leading the U.S. chapter on that for 30 years.
You go every year?
Every year. It's a walking pilgrimage from Paris to Chartres.
You know, yeah, maybe I'll join you next year.
Hey, come on over. Yeah, that'd be great. But there's where you see all everybody comes together and you lose your own, not your autonomy, because you have little chapters, but you lose the idea that I'm going to fly my flag. It's not about me anymore. All of a sudden, it's a microcosm of Christendom, and it's groups from all over the world, and it's fraternity and pious attendance. It's everybody. And you're just focused on that cathedral. You're focused on the Mother of God. You're focused on the rosary. You're focused on Catholic restoration for 3 days. And it works. And you find a beautiful camaraderie. And that's where the clans are literally united. And nobody is sitting there debating back and forth about, is he the Pope? Isn't he the Pope? And all that. Forget all that. We're just moving on, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that. That's a great model, I think. If you're around, you should think about maybe coming to the Catholic Identity Conference out in Pittsburgh every year. That's another thing that where we just literally said, let's get over ourselves. If this were a movie, we know we got the homosexual movement trying to infiltrate the church. We got the modernists infiltrate, progressive liberals infiltrating the church. Well, all of us down here, lay people, if it were a movie, we'd say, okay, Pius X, Fraternity of St. Peter. You know, we get this little difference about strategy, but behind these closed doors, we're all on the same side. So how do we go beat the bad guys, the really bad guys that hate Christ, trying to take over the church? So that was kind of how the model for that Catholic Identity Conference. If this were like a novel or a movie or whatever, we would get everybody together and we would talk about strategy and how we're going to, even if we have to remain somewhat divided publicly, privately, we're all on the same page. And I got to tell you, Taylor, it worked beautifully. We see these guys together now for the first time to see a fraternity in society, not in a false trad ecumenism like our friends like to accuse us of, but just men just saying, you're right. We are fighting for the kingship of Christ together. We do see something has assaulted our bride, the bride of Christ, the Holy Mother Church. And we need to do whatever we possibly can without phony compromise with each other, whatever we possibly can to defend as soldiers of Christ, the bride of Christ. It just makes perfect sense. And I think once you sort of challenge men to do that, we can get over this. We don't have to have absolute lockstep agreement on every strategic thing. We do have agreement on doctrine and liturgy. That's a lot to see if we can formulate some sort of an army, of a war, a machine to fight back. I mean, that's the way it's always been. You always had the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. You always had these different branches that most of the time didn't like each other too much, but they focused on a common enemy. And I think the idea of uniting the clans is not only a very simple thing to explain and defend, but it's already happening because the situation in the church is getting so bad. And maybe the fact that you and I are sitting here having this conversation is proof of that.
Yep.
People are done with fighting and the internecine squabbling amongst each other. And they'd like to see if we can, because I don't want to be alone. I don't know about you. I don't want to be the last guy standing with my stupid little sword. Yeah, here I go. I'm Don Quixote after the windmills. Right. I want you. I want a big army of guys who want to go to war with us and maybe survive this thing and keep the faith and raise our kids so they can keep the faith as well.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying all that, I was thinking, you know, I want an army. I want to fight. You know, I want generals and leaders and all that, brothers at arms. But the other element, as a father, I have 8 kids, is I want a culture for my kids and my grandkids to grow up. And I worry, who are my kids going to marry, you know? And, you know, yes, there's a certain number of younger people of the opposite sex at my local parish, but that doesn't mean that we're all going to intermarry there. I mean, there needs to be some sort of culture arising, which brings about new marriages and new children and new vocations and replaces itself for another generation, right? So, you know,
I think that what we're talking about today is actually what you just said. In other words, the creation of that culture, it has to do, and I'm going back again, because you seemed curious earlier in this program about the history, the early part of the traditional movement and all that.
Yeah.
The reason, I come from a family of nine children. Every one of them is traditional Catholic, and they have 8, 9, 10 kids. All their kids are traditional Catholics. Wow. Why is that? I think the reason is, it's not because we're something special or whatever. It's because my father created for us, and it wasn't, you know, created is probably the wrong word. He lived the crusade. It really was, as Catholics, we need to step up and answer the call because the church is being assaulted. So as little kids, we heard this idea of crusade. And it appealed to us. And even as little immature young people, there's a certain romance about that, like the Cristeros and the Vendée and all this stuff. We wanted to be a part of that. Michael Davies was like a freedom fighter to us when we were little. So it wasn't, you must be a traditional Catholic. You must go to the Latin. We never heard anything like that. It was, you've got the privilege to be part of a powerful movement if you got the guts and if you got the faith to do it. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what the Pilgrimage and Chart's all about, by the way, too. Very militant in style and in nature. Very spiritual, but very militant. It's the same sort of thing. So I think if we get past this idea, as fathers, I got seven, you got me by one, homeschool. If we get this past this idea that all we want is our Latin Mass, and we're going to go right along with the new Mass, we'll never criticize what's happening. That's not crusade.
Right.
This is not about us, just about us. It is about our spiritual survival. But the Catholic Restoration Movement, counter-revolution, is much bigger than just us. So if you give your kids this idea that we have no problem with what's going on in the new church, we have no problem with what's going on in the Vatican, we just want to have permission to have our little Latin Mass, I think that's self-defeating. Yeah. And I think then we are not going to build a Catholic culture based on the Catholic family, based on the social kingship of Christ, and all these beautiful things in history. The great stories of the Vendée, the great stories of the Cristeros, where Catholics were men and they fought like men and they kept the faith no matter what. If we give that to our kids, it is going to take care of itself. And we are going to find people for them to marry if we can spread this using video like you're doing, like I'm doing. Spread this idea so that you start to have families now. They're going to become self-sustaining in traditional Catholicism again, and they're going to be in love with it. And then you're going to find that I think we're going to have that culture is already building, and we will find places for our children to go to get married and all of that. I'm seeing it happen already. But it's directly dependent, in my opinion, on maintaining this idea of the Catholic crusade.
Yeah. You know, it kind of goes back to, on a spiritual level, back to Lefebvre. He could have just said, hey, we've got our Latin Mass. You know, we've got our priests. We've got our seminary. But he, as he began to get older and sick, he realized there has to be another generation.
Yeah.
I mean, he was willing to risk a papal censure because he realized this has to be a multi-generational fight. Mm-hmm. It's not just about me and my little group of people I've recruited. And that's, you know, whether you agree with it or not, that spirit, it's a fatherly spirit that Lefebvre demonstrated there of wanting to keep, pass on the torch. Is commendable.
Yeah, like didn't you start? Forgive my ignorance if I'm wrong, but didn't you start the Troops of St. George?
In 2013, I started the Troops. I looked at the Boy Scouts. I thought, I want my son's part of that with all the homo stuff going on. So I said, let's start a new thing, and we'll make the dads and the priests be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's the Troops of St. George.
I got some of my nephews that are involved with that, and that's what I'm talking about. Instead of you know, well, we're going to fix the Boy Scouts. These are fundamentally flawed institutions now, with people who are antithetical to everything that we believe. If we want to create the Catholic culture, we can't stay in there.
Yeah.
I remember talking to a Boy Scout guy whose kids were in the Boy Scouts. Sunday morning came along. This is a Catholic troop. Sunday morning came out. There were, I don't know how many, 20 kids and their dads. He was the only one that got up for Mass. They just slept right through Mass at a Catholic troop on a Sunday morning.
Right.
So you can't be a part of that. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, when you ask about culture, you're already doing it. You know, you start things. You go out and do the pilgrimage to Chart. You start the Troops of St. George. You get counter-revolutionary. You make it happen. And that's a beautiful thing. I've seen some of the photos of your work.
Yep.
It's fantastic. You know, you can see the kids are alive. They look like the Scout, little Scoots in France.
Yes, that's
They're
right.
They're just alive for the faith. They love it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's good for you. And I guess that's the answer. That's what we do. We got to continue to do that sort of thing.
I've wanted to get the Troops of St. George somehow incorporated with the Chart pilgrimage. I think it'd be just a perfect fit. So it's something.
I'm your guy.
All right. Let's talk about it. Because I'd love for them to be represented every year. Even if it was like a tradition that while you're in the Troops of St. George, you make that pilgrimage to Chart. I think it'd be cool.
Absolutely.
A cool add on. So. Well, tell us more about the Remnant and your work there. I love your videos. Everybody go check out. Is it Remnant TV? Is that the channel? Remnant TV. And what have you been doing there? And you got plans for the future, expanding that?
Yeah, we're expanding. What we're doing is we're seeing that, you're probably feeling the same pinch. I know that YouTube and Facebook and all that, these are not Catholic homes for us, for us much longer. So we built our own platform now for Remnant TV, and we're starting to get that, you know, installed. And I think that's the main thing, is just to be able to, you know, be self-sufficient and not have to rely on these people who are pretty antithetical to the faith. But yeah, it's expanding. It's doing really well. I never actually said, well, now I'm going to start a TV thing. We just said, well, you know, we still have a print edition newspaper, which I'll go to my grave defending because it's the one thing they can't control. These, right. You know, Facebook and all everybody. So we keep that going. But then it was pretty obvious to me, which I guess it became obvious to you too, that, you know, video is the future and you have to be able to address people. So we look at our videos as just another way of addressing very busy people now. And I've just been amazed by how it's just taken off. You know, yep. I mean, it's a small niche market, but it's really, really done pretty well. So which says to me, there are a lot of people out there who are starving for something to believe in. And a place like YouTube, at least for the moment, pretty good place to reach them. And I think as Catholics, we have an obligation to go in there and see what we can, if we can be missionaries to people who are never going to stumble across my newspaper, you know, and where they are. So yeah, we're doing great. We're busy as can be. You know, most of my kids are coming up and helping with the family business and all that. And I feel really waiting for the other shoe to drop. I mean, it's like the apocalypse all around. But you know, things here, they're doing all right. So yeah. I'm grateful to God.
And are you going to continue to do sort of the journalistic element of going to Rome and doing those videos? I thought those were really good.
Thanks. Yeah, I think we have to, right? Yeah. I mean, I just feel like we got to have a voice. And like I say, you know, going over there, you really made a lot of connections with people who are waking up, even in the press corps, you know, even people working for La Stampa, for example. And it's almost like maybe I'm wishful thinking, but some of the treatment that we received from them was so positive and so good, almost wink and nod kind of stuff. Wow. Like they're saying, too, something is really messed up in this town. Do what you can, you know. Yeah. So yeah, I think we have to do whatever we can, you know, without trying to, like, you know, impersonate the big guys at CNN or whatever. Just do what you can, and that's kind of what the Remnant's always been about. You just keep it real and go out and fight where you can. And if God favors our work, it's going to succeed. If He doesn't, and we're a bunch of, you know, we don't accomplish it, well, it'll die. Yeah. And at this point, it seems like we're making some progress. Like, you know, people like yourself are doing the same. Got to keep at it. Can't get discouraged. This is not the time to give up. It's not the time to just say, well, I'm going to fall on my knees and pray all the time. No, put yourself out there if you have the opportunity in the public square, because there are a lot of people that don't have anything right now. And we have the ability to say, hey, look at this. This is the Catholic thing. It actually works. It's very attractive right now.
Yeah.
So I like unite the clans. Absolutely. Everybody get involved in this. Stop the fighting against each other. If at all possible, just look at the target. Look at the end game. Fight as hard as you can. Say your rosary. Go to Latin Mass, and who knows where this might end up? You know, I'm full of positivity. I really am. I think that things are changing, and I don't see like the end of the world, the end of the church. I see a Catholic revival, maybe even in our lifetime. I hope so.
I feel like that's starting to happen. And the strange thing is Pope Francis, despite of the things he says, seems to be the one that God's using for people to, like you said earlier, wake up.
Yeah.
Unite, go into the history, read about it. I mean, the things your family was doing in the 60s and 70s, there's all these other people who are wanting to learn about that and uncover it. Do you think Francis will resign and pass the torch, or do you think he's going to hang on for 5-10 years now?
I think he's going to hang on. Don't you think? I mean, look at that personality. That is not the kind of guy that wants to shrink like the violet and go off and retire. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's having a good time.
Okay.
It's scarily so. I mean, it's terrifying.
I think you're right. I just worry with all the pressure, like you saw at the Rome summit, there's immense pressure with these scandals, these sexual scandals amongst the priests and the seminarians that, you know, will he eventually lose his creds to be a voice at all? And then the St. Gallen Mafia 2.0, whoever they are going to say, hey, you know, you're kind of muddied.
That's it. Well, that's interesting. Will he be forced out by Benedict? I think Benedict, forced out is dangerous, because if it was not an act of his own will, it's invalid. I think what they did is they manipulated an old man.
Yeah.
They said, you know, you saw what happened with John Paul. You don't want that to happen again when he got so old.
Yeah.
For the good of the church, blah, blah, blah. And Benedict, you know, okay. Yeah. I think he thinks he did it on his own, in other words.
Yeah.
So will they do something like that with Francis? Will they force him out? Yeah, I can see that, because he's not doing a good job right now. I mean, he really is messing up consistently. So that could happen. I just don't see him saying, I'm going to resign or, you know, abdicate for the good of the church. He just seems to be too into what he's doing.
Yeah.
But I think he is becoming a liability. And what they're going to do with that, I don't know.
Right.
Because, right. Yeah, he's playing into our hands way too much now.
You know? I know. Yeah, waking up people. Well, there it is. Unite the Clans. Everybody check out Remnant Magazine, Remnant TV here on YouTube. And like Michael Matt said, pray the rosary, attend the traditional Latin Mass, live your vocation. You're married, priest, raise your kids right, run your parish right, draw people closer to Jesus. And of course, pray that rosary every day. Our Lady of Victory, the battle, just like at Lepanto, right?
Absolutely.
It's won by the rosary. That is the weapon that we have, meditating on those mysteries. So everybody, thanks for watching. Please like this video, subscribe to Remnant TV over on YouTube. And if you like these videos, please support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dr. Taylor Marshall. And Michael Matt, thanks for coming on. Hope we can do this again sometime.
It was a pleasure, Taylor. Thanks very
much. All right. God bless.
God bless you.
Bye, everybody.
See you.
Has anyone ever asked you to explain a Catholic topic and stumped you? St. Peter, our first pope, once wrote this: always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. The problem is it takes years and even decades to study sacred scripture, the church fathers, magisterial documents, and councils. Most of us don't have that much time, even if we wanted to. So what if there were a way to have all of these answers prepared for us literally at our fingertips? My name is Dr. Taylor Marshall. I'm the founder of the New St. Thomas Institute, and we have created an online library of video and audio resources answering the most common objections against our Catholic faith. As a student member of the New St. Thomas Institute, you'll have access to our short and informative lessons by searching for the topics that interest you. For example, how to explain the Crusades, how to answer the top 10 atheist objections, how to answer Mormons when they come to your front door, and how to easily and quickly explain the Eucharist, the Blessed Virgin Mary, the papacy, the sacraments, and much more. You could easily spend thousands of dollars taking classes at universities or seminaries, but our tuition is the most affordable on earth. Plus, you'll have free access to our popular certificates in Catholic philosophy, Catholic theology, Catholic apologetics, church history, and New Testament studies. So if you're struggling with a topic and you need help, we have resources and answers waiting for you. Take your faith to the next level, become confident in your Catholic faith, join the New St. Thomas Institute today.